Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the theme, A New Way of Looking at Theological and Spiritual Ethical Agendas in the Age of Trump. My guest, Professor Harvey Cox, he is one of America's most preeminent theologians and the Hollis Research Professor Emeritus at Harvard Divinity School, the oldest professorship at Harvard going back to 1721. Professor Cox has been called one of the most important liberal theologians during the last half century and a leading trend spotter in American religion. He's also been a prominent civil rights and anti-war activist throughout his career. His book, The Secular City, published in 1965, remains one of the most read theological books in the nation and predicted much of what we now are witnessing unfolding as dogmatic religious beliefs become stronger and secular values take on higher spiritual value and meaning. 40 years ago, Professor Fox viewed this as a maturing of humanity and a divine gift rather than a threat to religion. Now at 87 years of age, Professor Cox has published yet another text, The Market is God, which lays down the argument, along with Pope Francis's observation that the capitalist market has been deified and has reached divine status in postmodern civilization, and consequently our ethical problems dealing with rampant inequality and climate change and global poverty are more difficult to solve. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Cox.
Yeah, great to be here, Gary.
I believe that the crisis we are observing right now across the United States, in particular in the Trump and as well as in the Obama White House, is an ethical and spiritual crisis that the nation needs to come to grips with. For that reason, I wanted to bring you on this program because you are one of our country's leading theologians who has studied moral theology. And I'd like to begin by going back to your first major book, The Secular City, which was written 52 years ago. You wrote, "We are trying to live in a period of revolution without a theology of revolution. The development of such a theology should be the first item on the theological agenda today." So you said. Now, since then, we now speak of spiritual values rather than theological morals. And you perceive spiritual ethics as compatible with secular values. And furthermore, we also witness a revolution in our midst. The Trump supporters, which include over 85% of the evangelical right, stage a revolution as well. Bernie Sanders attempted a revolution, and indeed, based upon the Trump's policies during the past 100 days, there is every indication that that revolution is underway. And it is going to impact our entire democracy and liberties and society. On the other hand, as some commentators have noted, there is another groundswell revolution of people waking up to a different set of values regarding the environment, ecology, social justice, anti-imperialism, and war. So as I see it, there are two separate revolutions underway at this historical moment. Not only for America, but in Europe and other nations as well. And on the one hand, there is this new liberalism emerging, and on the other, there is this entrenched conservatism related to a kind of religious nationalism that now rules the White House. So when you look back upon these 50-odd years since The Secular City was published, how were your predictions correct to the world today, and where might you have been mistaken or perhaps overly optimistic? Take your time. The forum is yours.
Yeah, well, I mean, you touched on a lot of them, didn't you? And I do think that there is a kind of a tension now between various views of what has to happen in the world. And the divide is deep. And it's pretty hard to see how it can be bridged, but there it is. I mean, everybody, no matter left, right, center, up, down, has a feeling that something is changing and something needs to change. Some people are deeply fearful of what they think is changing. Other people are hopeful and looking forward to some of the things we see on the horizon. So it's going to be an interesting time to live in. And it is true that my field is religion, and has been for many, many decades now. If you look at that, you see the divide very vividly. I mean, you have on the one hand the people you just referred to, all those evangelicals who supported Trump, who didn't seem to be very much of an example of the kinds of things that they hold up as valuable and worth emulating. You have that on the one side. On the other side, you have you have Pope Francis, an articulate and determined advocate for a changing, very basic change. I mean, he's very concerned about the grip that what he calls the deified market and consumerism has on a lot of people's consciousness. He's very concerned about divisive nationalism, about the exclusion of people from a growing what he calls insensitivity and exclusiveness. So we see it reflected there, and I'm not surprised. I mean, religion also, after all, is part of life. And it's going to be part of these severe divisions that we face.
We are a divided nation. I believe one of the turning points that kept Hillary Clinton from being elected, which had nothing to do with the FBI or Russians hacking into the DNC committee and stealing their secrets, but rather, it was the night that she said that over half the American electorate, you're talking about over 65 million people, were deplorables.
Yeah.
And think of the consequence if you're telling half the American electorate you have no values. You're white trash, you're racist, you're xenophobic. And she does not know these people. None of us have been out there talking with all those people, know them personally, know their real values. And I thought that was a terrible, terrible thing to do.
It was a terrible faux pas, but it's really shooting herself in the foot. One of my friends who's in politics said, you can criticize your political enemy, never criticize your enemy's supporters. It doesn't get you anywhere. In fact, you only lose by doing that. I think calling anybody deplorables. You know, I have to say, Gary, in all honesty, that members of my own family, some of my brothers, were Trump supporters and continue to be Trump supporters, and I don't think of them as deplorable. I think of them as misguided or mistaken in some of the things they do. They watch too much Fox and not enough anything else. They're upset about things, and they were attracted to somebody who seemed to proffer the answer. Here I am. I have the answer. We're going to take care of that. We're going to take care of this. I think it was naive of them to do that, but deplorable was certainly a terrible, terrible word. And I agree with you. I think that cost her a lot, perhaps even the edge of the election.
I happen to have lived in my life when I was younger in Wheeling, West Virginia, in Weirton, West Virginia, in Steubenville, Ohio, in Katanning, Pennsylvania, an old Polish coal mine town.
Right.
And when I lived in these places, there was a deep economic slump. The people who I knew, when I sold Cub Scout uniforms and L.S. Good department store in their basement before I went to work for Singer Sewing Machine fixing sewing machines. These were decent people. They had simple values. They believed in community and family. They generally stayed their entire life in the same neighborhood, the same communities. And whatever their religion, that generally tended to stay with them throughout their life. And they look forward to simple things. If you ask someone, what are you looking forward to?
Oh, we're looking forward.
Yes. Yes. And holidays and anniversaries. Mm-hmm. And they were not at any time deep into politics.
Right.
Now, when I go back now and I visit with friends from West Virginia, where I grew up, or I go down to where I also lived in West Texas, and I had the Healing Springs Ranch down there, and I talk with the people in Texas, the same type of feedback I'm getting. Why did you vote for Trump? It's not because they like him. It's not because they associate with this bombast and his egomania. It's because, as one said it, and this person just said this 2 weeks ago to me, Gary, I wanted Clinton to do the right thing, and they didn't for 8 years. I wanted Obama to do the right thing, and they didn't for 8 years. They made promises. They never resolved those promises. So I'm at a place where anyone who tells me they're going to do something, I half don't believe them, but the other half I hope they do. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats have stopped even coming up with things they can do for us. So that's why I did. So if you denigrate all those tens of millions of people, you're setting up for a national moral conflict. It's not just a difference in ideologies or politics, but you're not looking to see how many Americans go to bed hungry, how many are living on welfare, how many are living on food stamps, how many are homeless. And if we don't see that picture and don't hear their stories, and we're not, then what does that tell us about the depth of our moral commitment to helping put ourselves into other people's lives so we can help make a difference?
Yeah, and that last phrase is exactly what putting yourself in other people's shoes or seeing the world through their eyes is exactly what we would hope some of the best insights of the religious traditions would give us. Love your neighbor as yourself. Take in the stranger because you were once a stranger. All of these things. These are values that we have to somehow or another reemphasize and also be able to interpret them and apply them in a way that's credible. And I take some responsibility as a person who's worked in religious communities. We haven't communicated it very well, I don't think. We've said these things, but we haven't really communicated them that well. But let me tack on to what you just said about the dismal situation. I think that the fact that it's so dismal and that we're seeing such egregious violations of some of our deepest loyalties and values now is going to really stimulate the other side. I think it's going to be a real wake-up call to a lot of people, and that we may see something very positive coming out of this. Now, I hope that isn't just sanguine or whistling in the dark. I don't think it is. I look around the country. I mean, look around my two daughters. Both went off and marched with the Women's March, you know, and proudly sent me selfies that they had taken. They're alive and alert to this sort of thing, as well as a lot of my students here. I think there is something stirring, and it needs to be given some encouragement and some direction. But I think it's really there.
I agree. Well, following up on that, during the first conversation we had, I'm guessing it was around 7-8 years ago, we talked about a new age of spiritual emerging where spiritual values and morals replace dogmatic religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious what you now perceive this trend today, and especially among the younger generation, like your daughters, who are now coming into the millennial generation or older children. I have older daughter also. And how they are looking at these issues. Are they looking at them just pragmatically? Are they looking at them with a sense of moral outrage that how could anyone, corporations, government agencies, be defiling our earth, exploiting finite resources? What do you see as this dynamic becoming?
You know, I do think they're responding out of a sense of very profound moral values. I noticed about 2 or 3 years ago, something you might have noticed as well, the number of people who now like to describe themselves by saying, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, or I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. So I organized a small group of students here to do a little research project with me and locate people like that, as many as they could find, and ask them to explain, what do you mean by this? And the result of our little survey was, you know, quite a few people, we talked to quite a few people, was they said something like, look, I'm not an atheist. Don't think of me as an atheist. That's not who I am. But I don't like the packaging and this the in which the traditional religious values are being distributed to us or handed on to us. And by that, if you push them a little further, they meant, yes, they meant an emphasis on doctrines instead of values, and an overemphasis on the institution and loyalty to the institution, participation in the institution. And they want to have the core of the reality, the spiritual reality that we all know somehow or another at one point or another in our lives, often very often, is real. Without the encumbering structures around it that have made it so unavailable to many people. So once again, I see this as a very hopeful sign. They're not giving up, and they know that the spiritual dimension of life is not just an option, but it's absolutely essential to survive and to produce some kind of positive change.
I absolutely agree with you in that I see it in small ways. Many times we only look for the big ooh-ah instead of the subtle, almost non-recognizable adjustments. For example, shopping at a farmer's market for locally grown organic produce.
Right.
That is a radical spiritual concept because it shows the reverence for the environment, especially those of us who are on plant-based diets. It shows a respect for all sentient beings, including the animals. But yet the average person wouldn't recognize any of that. Whether or not someone donates some of their time on a regular basis to be a big brother, a big sister, whether you go to a place where people are suffering and say, friend, how can I help and make a little difference here? It's those little gestures. Even when you have a neighborhood where you find, go out and ask your neighbors, are you about to lose your home? And if so, be honest with me. We've been neighbors for, you know, a long time here.
Mm-hmm.
How can I help you?
Right,
can I give you a place to store some of your stuff? And we're not doing some of that, and we should be, because it's some of those small ways that we could and would and maybe even had the desire to. But we have to have the confidence to say, I am a spiritual being in this life. I am more than my politics. I am more than my possessions. I am more than my indoctrination or rituals.
I agree completely.
Do you see that happening?
Yeah. And, you know, I also see it happening in some in many, many, many local congregations, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, and so on, at the local level. I wish there were more of it going on at the middle level. In the Catholic Church, it's happening at the very top, and it's happening down at the very bottom. It's just the bishops and the prelates in between who don't seem to get the message. But, for example, the little congregation, fairly small congregation, that I belong to here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, boy, oh, boy, I mean, people are so engaged now in environmental protection, climate change. And now the church has voted to declare itself a sanctuary church, and we take it very seriously. We've engaged lawyers to help us, linguists, nurses, and doctors for the people who may eventually seek sanctuary in our building. We have the beds set up, and there are three or four other churches in our community who've done the same thing, and we're forming a little kind of coalition of sanctuary churches. It is happening, and it's for some people, a lot of people, they do relate it to the spiritual tradition that they find themselves in. Some don't, but many do. In our little church, of course, we do that, but others don't, and it doesn't really matter in a way, as long as the essential core values get expressed and acted on. The packaging, as I just said, is not the essential part. What's inside is what's essential.
Wasn't it William Blake who said, "A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent"?
I hadn't heard that, but it sounds good.
Yeah. I'm looking at two different dualistic constructs right now, and I'd like your input on it. I believe that the way that we, yourself and several thousand others who have very progressive and spiritual values, if we understood that the message should not be to the institutions, because almost everyone out there associates with institutions, and therefore the brand is what is protected.
Yeah.
It is like corporations now have the same rights as individuals. Citizens United gave it to them. Instead of looking at the individuals, and I believe that much of what we have done is not been as fruitful as it could be, because we're trying to move the mountain. Mountains are not going to move. Corporations are not going to reform themselves. You're not going to get all the wonderful things that we would like to. But individuals do change. It depends upon who's influencing them and the people that could make a difference. For example, if the Pope decided to call upon all Catholics, and if the head of the Methodist, Presbyterian, and Episcopalian and other churches in the United States decided, let us go to a once a week plant-based diet. Just start there. That's not so radical. Mm-hmm. And why? What would it do for the health of the person, and hence the health of their family and community? Because it's much better to be able to celebrate a life in a joyful, healthy way than to be celebrating a person's life after they've died from a disease they could have prevented. Your thoughts about maybe focusing more of our energy upon the individuals instead of the institutions and the entity that has all the power, because corporations don't change.
No, corporations are not going to change, and it's by the individuals within them changing and having a vision that little changes could happen in corporations. I gave a course here at Harvard for 2 years, beginning last year and the year before, that I called God and Money. I was trying to get people to think seriously about money, wealth, poverty, inequality from a spiritual perspective. We had students from various different religious traditions in there. And what cheered me most, first of all, there's a lot of interest in the course, but what really cheered me most was some students from the business school, which is way across the river from where I generally teach, the Harvard Business School, found their way over the Charles River and up through the parking lots and signed up for this course. And I got to know those guys pretty well. There were four guys and one woman from the business school, and met with them several times during the semester. And I was impressed by their high idealism. They wanted to help people. They thought that businesses had some role and had some power to help the poor, help impoverished and alienated and excluded people, but they found themselves sort of caught up in the, the kind of undertow of the business culture, of the commercial consumer society. But they were fighting back and finding each other and finding other people within those structures. So I thought, even if they were the only people in the course, having given them some vision of what might be possible, it was sort of worth giving the course. That's, by the way, what I was out of that course that I wrote this book called The Market is God, to bring to people's attention how we have erected, what Pope Francis calls another golden calf. The golden calf is back, and it's consumerism and the deified market. Now, he's really very explicit about that. And I think he's right.
Because he is showing the deification of brands. In the United States, corporations are taking over, and at a record rate, taking over other corporations because they want the brand.
Yeah.
They can always get the product made in another country by exploiting cheap labor. And
they don't even need to make the same product as long as it has the brand. It's
that's all they
people.
Can. And it, all the commercials and jingles on television for the last 60 years, based upon Brené, the great publicist, is get a person associated with a brand. Well, now the Tea Party was a brand, and Rush Limbaugh was a brand. Bill O'Reilly was a brand.
Right.
And these people became brands. And I'm concerned about that because I think we should wean ourselves off these brands by seeing them for what they are. Now, I'd like for you, if you would please, to take a trip back. When Bill Clinton started his second term in 1997, crime, drugs, and unemployment were America's top concerns. When Bush arrived in 2001, religious and moral decline was one of the top concerns, along with education and crime. And for the first time, a dissatisfaction with government. That's when we saw it. And then when Obama enters in 2009, the economy and unemployment were the overwhelming major concerns
for
most people.
Oh, yeah, they went to tank.
And terrorism, the war on Iraq, the national security state barely registered in the surveys. Then comes Trump, and for the first time, immigration appears in the top three concerns, along with religious and moral decline and dissatisfaction of the government, all of which were talking points that framed the Trump campaign. Yet these concerns also reflect a high degree of fear within the American population and fear of the other and foreign with respect to immigration, and fear of liberals and fear of secular values and fear of government taking away citizens' liberties and freedoms.
Right.
So
right.
My simple question is, why are Americans so afraid? And is it accurate to speak about the theology of fear, which has been promulgated by the religious right and religious supremacist groups, such as the Tea Party, that make up most of Trump's supporters?
Well, no, I think fear, it's because fear has been stoked. These groups have spread and stoked fear because fear motivates people to do things. They don't think clearly if they're acting out of fear, and they can be led to believe that we can respond to your fear by doing this or that, you know, by building a wall the whole way across the border, by kicking out anybody who is a Muslim or not allowing them in. It's fear is a very, very, very powerful motivator, very powerful, and it can be engineered and it can be deployed, and has been. And not as relatively new, I think. I mean, there are perfectly good reasons why people have the capacity to fear. I think it's built into the human psyche. It's a survival device. You have to know if you're in danger. But stoking artificial fears, you know, this whole business, for example, of immigration. There isn't as much immigration as there used to be, and the latest statistics show that slightly more people are going back over the Rio Grande to Mexico than are coming this way. And yet the picture that's painted is of these hordes of people that he called, you know, murderers and rapists and all those people who are coming in. It's stoking fear with what is patently not true. But somehow or another, fear of the unknown is the worst kind of fear. Have you ever noticed that the people who never met any Muslims are the ones who are most fearful and afraid of them? Or people who don't know any Jews are the anti-Semites, or on and on? Some familiarity with people who are different in one respect or another from us is the best antidote, I think. But we have a society now which is rather segmented, including gated communities and forms of segregation that simply haven't gone away because of housing prices and all the rest. And we don't know and meet and see each other as much as we might. So there's that underlying possibility of fear in the human psyche, which can be pricked and bloated and made use of by cynical forces. And even the people we were just talking about, advertisers, can tell you, look, here's a terrible disease you may have. And here's what we have to sell you to get away from that disease. they have to put a little granule of fear in there in order to set you up for the sale. It's very useful.
My final question has two parts. Trump's cabinet, as you're aware, is full of hardline fundamentalists. Most are Christians, who apparently see no problem in turning over the entire economy and our nation to ruling oligarchs. Vice President Mike Pence, Betty DeVos in the Department of Education, Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Ben Carson running HUD, and others. How do you account for this allegiance between big business and Wall Street and the administration that is supposed to embrace Christian ethics? And what is, in your estimation, is the perversion of Christianity that these people represent?
What's my explanation? Boy, if I could tell you that. I'm bamboozled. I'm puzzled by the blatant contradiction between what many of these people, including Trump himself, stand for and what is so evident in at least the religious tradition I belong to, but I could point out parallels in other religions as well. I mean, just think of the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, the things that Jesus talked about, or the Old Testament prophets. Line them up on one side of the page and line up what these people are doing on the other side, and there's a clear contradiction. And I am I'm pretty puzzled about how they don't see that. I wish I could. It's something I think about almost every day and talk to people about. Do you have any idea how that happened?
I believe that they are living in a cognitive disconnect.
Uh-huh.
I believe that they... Remember, we always have this notion that good people do bad things and smart people do stupid things, and that has become ingrained in us, and I believe just the opposite. Bad people do bad things, stupid people do stupid things, smart people do smart things, and good people do good things, but we're not consistent. And therefore, it's not lack of consistency where a person could be a genius and the smartest person in the block doing one thing and then go into another area of their life that they have not mastered and be just as susceptible to being conditioned by all that's come before it. And hence the idea that the real world should be to us in the way of knowledge as if we had just picked up one grain of sand from the ocean floor. So that's about the value of our degrees and our expertise. Look at all the other grains of sand that you have yet to master. And that's why we have the people acting out as such fools in positions of power.
Yeah, and once you get that taste for power, it really is an elixir. You can really get off on it, and you hate to give it up. And that's of course what they're doing. And remember that these people at the top there are not only highly conservative religiously, if they have a religion. I don't think Donald Trump really has much of one, but they're also enormously wealthy. They're billionaires. How many billionaires are there in his cabinet? Now, I think probably he has the largest number of billionaires any cabinet has ever had in American history.
Seven.
And that means they live in a particular kind of world. The other people they meet, the places they eat, the way they travel, the things that they see, the televisions they watch. It is a kind of a bubble. And it reinforces on a daily basis whatever little grain of sand, as you mentioned, they think is the whole beach.
It's also power is as addictive as any opiate. It was an old English proverb that says, "He who despises his own life is soon master of another's."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And because people who truly are happy don't want to master anyone else's life or control over it. And you see more often than not an entire industry that allows you to have power to buy something bigger, better than other people. Last night there was this extravaganza that they do once a year for this woman who looks like Bo Peep Ann Wigmore, who's supposed to be the great fashionado. And yet all these people dress up as if somehow that makes them a better person because they are allowed to come to an exclusive ball and everyone is not. So the moment you have power, doors open that have never opened before. people are there to encourage you to continue using your power, sharing your power with them, and never go back. Do you ever notice that when people become powerful, they move out of their neighborhoods, they don't dress the same, they don't socialize the same,
no.
They become the person that they thought they ideally should be, but they're terrified if people recognize them for who they were. And that is the great deceit of power.
They become sort of a caricature of themselves, sort of a caricature, which they then sort of live out.
You're absolutely right. They always have. And that's why they become, even if they don't want to be anti-science. Now, if you're in that group, you have to be anti-science. You have to deny global warming. You have to deny poverty. You have to deny inequality. You have to deny everything the common sense, reason, and proof shows exist. Because after all, you now are sharing in that sacred ethereal space of power. Mm-hmm. And we thank you very much for what you have done in sharing this book, The Market as God, Harvard University Press. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, Gary. Well, call again sometime. I always enjoy it.
We will.
Okay.
Professor Bye. Harvey Cox is one of America's most preeminent theologians and the Hollis Research Professor Emeritus at Harvard Divinity School, and by many accounts, the most significant intellectual theologian around. Now, he was only able to do a half hour. So what I wanted to do in the second half of our program is I wanted to open this up, which we rarely, if ever, do on our Progressive Commentary Hour, to talk back. Now, let me explain first, before you call in, what you're calling in about. I was listening this morning when I was driving to the radio, and the only station I could get was Fox, and Glenn Beck's program was on, and they seemed to mock and ridicule everything they fear, which is anything progressive. And unfortunately, they labeled anything that is Democrat or liberal as progressive. It is not. Let me explain what I consider a manifesto for progressive ideals and what I would like to see people work on. The reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act to gain separate savings and loan banking from speculative investment banking. Ban trading in commodities that are necessary to life. For example, you cannot profit by speculating in prices on water, on food, and even on oil. Support a thorough investigation of the background and corporate institutional influence of Trump's, all of his associates. And they should have done it with Obama, Clinton, and Bush and Reagan, and they did not. Close down the Federal Reserve and turn over all money printing and distribution at zero interest to the U.S. Treasury, where it originally was supposed to occur. Forgive debt. Forgive all interest debt above 1%, because the banks are getting it for zero. So they're still making as much as 100% profit. And also declare a moratorium on all home foreclosures. Allow people to stay in their homes by providing 15% of their income. Forgive all student loans. And then from that moment on, say, if you go to a private institution, you pay. If you go to a state institution, it's tuition free. Repeal all of Bush's bankruptcy laws that prevented student loan holders from declaring bankruptcy. Also, create a national food program to see that the tens of millions of Americans, including over 16.8 million children, are properly fed. Not garbage, not junk, not expired food you find at some of these food banks, but in every single community in America, public funds from the federal government should go to create sustainable food programs in the inner city and in the suburbs, so anyone who is food insecure could go there and obtain fresh, organic, healthy food. De-ghettoize America, going into ghettos and rebuilding them. Rebuilding them using structures that are still habitable and destroying all the rest and putting in sustainable housing that is environmentally positive. Also, use the labor and build guilds and trade schools so that people within the communities who are being de-ghettoized can also earn a living wage as well as benefit from being there. You would have treatment centers, addiction centers, gang exit centers, people coming out of prison centers, halfway houses that are habitable, where people can go and have quality of life. You should also have campuses built in every community in the United States for people coming back from wars, or people who have been in wars who are back but suffering post-traumatic stress disorder and not able to assimilate into society. By having places that are hospitable with humanistic psychologists and psychotherapists, by having people to detoxify from depleted uranium and vaccines, by having holistic medical treatment, and then having the people there regain their sense of self and have a place where their family can come so that they get off the drugs, get off the meds, detoxify, and can reenter society. Close down and decommission all nuclear power plants and shift that investment to support geothermal, solar, wind, and wave energy. Ban all funding for any election. Take every single dollar out of politics. In fact, make it a federal crime if a person is caught funding anything. Create a program of reforestation. Recreate millions of trees per state, as well as hedgerows and all around the barrier islands, like in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, to bring in the mangrove forest, the things that can help prevent major flooding. Repair our bridges, our levees, our waterways, our gas mains, using skilled labor to do so and not allowing major corporations to get the bid who have no experience or background in doing it and then make their profit plus and give it off. No, this should be done by the federal government, much like FDR did it, and we could put at least 10 million Americans to work. Start demilitarization of forces around the globe. We have over 900 bases. Close them all down. Conduct an investigation into the influence of agricultural corporations such as Monsanto on American foreign policy and outlaw genetically modified foods. Cease all gas hydrofracking and offshore drilling. Allow all corporations that cannot be maintained to go through structured bankruptcy and never again give a never bailout to any corporation. Ban lobbying. Make it a federal offense if you lobby any state or federal office. Create a national health preventative program that is mandatory in schools and in every community where people learn the true reason why we get sick to begin with. Acknowledge the dangers of depleted uranium in all conflict zones and set up groups of public health officials overseen by Dr. Doug Rocky, who had done this before, to go into these countries and help get rid of the depleted uranium as best as possible, but also help treat the people who have been victims of it. Include only a single-payer health coverage under Medicare, and there would be no reason for anyone ever to go broke again because of medical disease. Reform the USDA and take all politics out of it. Also, get us out of all trade agreements, get out of the World Trade Organization, and financial reform for all banks. Also, stop all spying on all American citizens and close down all the American spy agencies and only have one that has a minimal staff that is responsible to a civilian oversight group that is also made up of people from progressive communities who have spent their lifetime challenging spy agencies. Return public airwaves to the people. Stop environmental degradation. Stop developments where it is not sustainable. Stop home foreclosures. Ban credit default swaps and derivatives. Create a 20% flat tax for all corporations so nobody could have any deduction to get out of paying their fair share. That alone would bring in an extra $1.2 trillion per year. Also, stop all challenges to people exercising their freedoms in the United States, their constitutional freedoms. Stop criminalizing our freedoms. Create a quality educational system not based upon privatization, but based upon the ability to create critically challenging courses so students learn how to think. Stop all asset forfeiture without probable cause and hold any policeman or police force legally liable if they should seize assets based upon a person being innocent. Support small businesses by giving them interest-free loans up to $5 million if they, for each million, hire 2 employees at a living wage. That would put an additional 10 to 15 million people to work. Also, address all of our environmental degradation and global warming. Put any corporation that is not willing to put its profits into cleaning up its pollution out of business. Stop Citizens United, repeal it, give term limits of one 2-year term only for any public office. Support multi-party systems and debates. Do not allow any debate where all small parties are not allowed an opportunity to participate, at least up to a certain number. Take all profit out of our healthcare system. That would save over $2 trillion a year. Expose ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and tens of thousands of the laws that they have passed, and repeal every law that ALEC has secretly been passing in state after state, and have a hall of shame for the people who sold their souls as legislators to allow that. Clean up all toxic Superfund sites. Promote only sustainable agriculture. Challenge all massive mergers and monopolies. Protect all whistleblowers. Depoliticize all federal agencies. Create civilian oversight and advocacy boards in every community in America. Challenge corporate charters. Henceforth, under a truly progressive way of living, if a corporate leader of anyone in a corporation knowingly created a product or service that they knew in advance would undermine the health or cause death, disease, or injury, that entire corporation loses its charter, and hence the people responsible will be held personally, criminally liable. Close all debtors' prisons. Stop all private prison systems. Put a minimum of, or I should say put a maximum, on all non-violent crimes of no more than 2 years. And first, allow those individuals to serve that constructively in communities where they can be monitored without being stigmatized, brutalized, and raped within the prison system. Stop the war on drugs. Legalize all drugs and establish treatment and counseling centers in every community in America to help those who are suffering. Free every nonviolent drug-related prisoner in America and expunge their records. Stop all sales of weapons to anyone. Convert all those industries to peacetime productions. Create a truth and reconciliation court for every state and federal employee, past and present, to come forward and confess their crimes and to give clemency or charge them if they have not come forward. Think of what we would learn from the federal agencies like the CIA and the FBI if people could not be prosecuted, but they would end up telling us the truth of what had happened. Ban the privatization of water, like Nestle's. Stop all mining and exploitation of resources on national and state parks and Native American lands, and honor all the Native American treaties. Those are some true progressive values. Your thoughts. Time for Talk Back. We're going to take a quick break here. And our number to call in now to share your comments and points of view, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, and it is the most listened to of all the radio programs I do each week, and it's heard all over the world. So it's your opportunity now to call in and share your points of view. I'm sure you have them. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. have taken calls on the Progressive Commentary Hour, so it might be a little startling for people. So I'm going to give you some additional thoughts of how we can create some primary core progressive values. And if I see my engineer tells me we have some calls, I will certainly put the word out. I might mention that in three weeks, the third Sunday of this month at 7 p.m., I'm going to do a webinar. That webinar will be a film that you have not seen, and then about 2.5 hours of discussion where I'll be answering a lot of questions. But I'm going to share some unique, original information you have not heard ever about how to slow down and reverse the aging process, how to help people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, myasthenia gravis, memory loss, depression and anxiety, and how you can get an old body looking and feeling young again, and how there's so much new science that people are not aware of how we can rejuvenate. Just go to GaryNall.com or ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com if you're interested in being a part of that. The last two webinars I've done over the last 4 months have been packed, and I'm sorry a lot of people are not able to get on, and even though we twice had to expand our bandwidth, so please make an effort to get on early. Now, here are some primary core progressive values. First and foremost, the freedom from undue government interference in our lives. I'm a person who believes that you should have the freedom to associate with who you want. You should have the freedom of a religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Right now, anyone expressing a freedom that in any way challenges the government or corporate interest is put on a domestic terrorist watch list. If you have a group, even a peaceful group, if you have an environmental group that wants to save the redwoods or wants to protect national parks from not being exploited, the likelihood is Homeland Security, according to WikiLeaks, will infiltrate you. And you could even have Asian provocateurs trying to set you up so that you'll do something that they can then have you arrested for. We shouldn't be fearful, those of us who are trying to do good by the world, by people, by human rights, by animal rights. We should not fear that we are now the enemies of the state. But right now, that is the case. We should have the freedom to live a fulfilling and secure life with economic security and opportunity. How can we do that when you've had over $6 trillion coming into the economy, almost exclusively into the hands of a small oligarchical group in the last 7 years? And those people do not spread that money. They own corporations where they're making billions of dollars in profits, yet they want to give you a minimum wage. They don't want to give you health insurance. And frequently now you have to work two jobs and live in abject poverty just to be able to feed your family. So I believe that it is not for a lack of resources that we have inequality. It is a lack of spiritual values. And it goes clear down the chain. It's not just the people who have a fiduciary responsibility to make profits their number one priority, but it's also for all those stockholders who want to see the maximum return on their investment. It's all the people on Wall Street, the financial writers, who say this is a well-managed company because it gives maximum return on investment. But what if in the process they create products that are toxic, they exploit environments, they exploit people? Is that ever taken into the equation? And the answer is no, never. So we need to stand up and speak out when we are not being given the right to have, with all of our effort and all of our labor, an opportunity to benefit from it. Also, political equality regarding faith, race, gender, sexual orientation. Personal responsibility for each other benefits the common good of society. Public interest of the many trumps public interests of the few. And responsibility includes ecological, environmental, and social sustainable issues. For example, the Koch brother factories are responsible for its pollution, to all living within its vicinity, the water, the air, and people. And yet, because it's profitable, the only question is supporting the profitability of the company and its right to pollute and pay a fine. It cannot undo, by paying that fine, the damage it's done to people. The planet is all of our home, and we must take care of what we do with it and be conscious. Being able to eat vegan, being able to use paper instead of plastic, being able to recycle things, be able to take clothes and alter them and so that we can give them to others or reuse them ourselves instead of always growing the economy. Progressives don't look to grow the economy. They look at sustaining an economy. And that means frequently saying no to the clutter, no to this massive desire to consume foods we don't need that are unhealthy in amounts that can only bloat us and be a burden to our health. We have to be progressives in that we take our money out of their banks and put them into the smaller banks and the smaller credit unions and look carefully at the things that matter, like a vaccine. If you cannot be convinced by independent research that a vaccine has been shown to be safe and effective individually and collectively, all of its ingredients, then why would you put it into a still immature developing body? You wouldn't, and yet that's what we've been doing. We need to repeal the Patriot Act. We need to repeal the National Defense Authorization Act. We need to repeal any act that gives the government the right to treat us without committing any crimes as if we have. All of the power and all the resources in America always tend to side or align with private interest. And that's unfortunate. We don't need Homeland Security. We don't need the Defense Department. We don't need the Federal Reserve. We don't need the CIA. We just think we do because we have been propagandized that these are so important. We don't need NATO. We don't need the UN. We need a conciliation by seasoned humanistic diplomats who are not naive but conscious of the role of diplomacy and detente in resolving conflicts. We need to ban capital punishment. We need to reduce prison sentences, and we need not to put anyone who's committed a nonviolent crime in prison. We need to restore the pre-Clinton prison programs, such as education, not Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton's and Obama's pro-prison slave labor programs. We need to expand Social Security. We need to restore health agencies that truly are interested in the public health and not in special interest. We need to look at life as if we can start over and help those who want to have the tools to do so. And for those of us as individuals, that's what we've been doing, and it works. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening to today's Progressive Commentary Hour. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.